Solo voy con mi pena, sola va mi condena. Correré mi destino para burlar la ley. Perdido en el corazón de la grande Babilón. Me dicen el clandestino por no llevar papel. Pa' una ciudad del norte yo me
fui a trabajar. Today we're going to be talking about race and immigration, and specifically making some links to what we were talking about last week, which was more about talking about race as a concept, and making the shift from talking about race as a concept to talking about race in the particular context of the United Kingdom. And this involves two moves. One is looking back to what we were doing in the first couple of weeks and looking at the link between race and what Barna Hesse calls post-coloniality and immigration, and also looking forward to some of the stuff we're going to be doing next week when we talk about citizenship and identity, and also to a certain extent in week five when we talk about race and culture and the idea of multiculturalism. Okay, so here's a quick overview of what we're going to be... Oh, sorry, I just wanted to say that this is, if you like, going from this idea of imperialism to one of immigration, picture there of early migrants from the Caribbean coming to Britain, and perhaps to this image here, which at least the government tries to sum up as being somehow representative of what British multiculturalism is about. So that kind of shift is what we're talking about. Okay, so quick overview of what we're going to be doing today. Firstly, I'm going to be doing a history of immigration to the UK and giving you a brief overview of what the main topics I want you to concentrate on are. Secondly, we're going to be looking at the popular reaction to immigration and perhaps asking some questions as to what extent this is really a popular reaction or to what extent there might be the influence of the media and, of course, of the state. Thirdly, we'll be talking about the political response to immigration, so in terms of various immigration policies and how they've changed over the years. And fourthly, we'll be talking about immigration today and what has often been referred to as a crisis in immigration. And there'll be links made from that brief discussion to, again, what we'll be discussing in the next couple of weeks, where I take up these themes again, because, of course, in Britain and in Europe in general, immigration has often been defined contra the idea of who we are. So the national identity of Britain is often defined in relation to its immigrants. So those are the four themes I want to work on today. Okay, briefly, the early days of immigration. I'm not going to spend too long on this, but I think it's important to point out that, contrary to popular myth, Britain has never been a homogeneous society from a cultural point of view. Migration can be traced back to the Roman era, and there have been Jews present in Britain, for example, since the Norman conquest. The history of the Jews' presence in England is quite interesting and went through various changes, notably after the expulsion from Spain in 1492. Many Jews sought refuge in Britain. So we have, if you like, a long history of being a place where people fleeing persecution want to come. We should also think about there being an important Indian presence in Britain. I read today that Indians are amongst one of the top groups of people with, you know, people whose origins are born outside Britain. Indians are amongst the top numbers there. But Indian presence in Britain goes way back to the post-war period and back to early trading between Britain and India as part of the East India Trading Company. So it's important to think about the longevity of migrants' presence in Britain. Last year saw the commemoration of the abolition of slavery, and this brought to light the fact that there has been important links in the trade of slaves between Britain and colonial countries back as far as 1555. The first Englishman recorded to have taken slaves from Africa was called John Locke. He was a London trader who in 1555 brought to England five slaves from Guinea. A second London trader taking slaves at that time was William Tarrison, whose fleet sailed into Plymouth following his 1556 voyage to Africa and from Plymouth on his 1557 voyage. And interestingly, there is something I didn't know, but that picture, Penny Lane, everybody knows is that Beatles song, but actually Penny Lane is called after a famous Liverpudlian slave owner whose name was Penny. Okay, so jumping a little bit forward from there, we're all aware of the history of immigration from the early post-World War II period onwards. What actually happened was that British subjects, people were not thought of as immigrants in those days because they were actually subjects of the Queen, if you like, under the Commonwealth, were recruited to rebuild Britain, whose cities, of course, had been destroyed after the devastating blitzes of the Second World War. There's perhaps a common misperception that people, you know, migrated freely, in a sense. Of course, people wanted to migrate to Britain, but there was also recruiting kind of agencies, employment agencies, if you like, going across to the former colonies and actually seeking people to come and work here. And there was a lot of the arrival of what were called Commonwealth immigrants at that time were, you know, recruited into labour. This clip from an early newsreel is quite telling. It shows the arrival of people from the Caribbean coming off the boats into London and talking quite positively about the nature of their presence here.
More than 400 happy to make them. They've come to seek work in Britain and are ready and willing to do any kind of job that will help the motherland along the road to prosperity. They're all full of hope for the future, so let's make them very welcome as they begin their new life over here.
Okay, it's important to note that at this time there was no thinking of these people as being immigrants. It's not until 1962 and a change in the legislation that we have a shift in thinking about people from the former Commonwealth as anything but subjects of the British Empire. Of course, immigrant experiences at this time were not quite as rosy as was painted in the film. Despite a belief in the motherland, new Commonwealth immigrants faced racism and exclusion, alienation and discrimination. Often in searching for housing, people, not only black immigrants, but also people from the Indian subcontinent and Irish immigrants also coming over to look for work, met with the signs, no dogs, no blacks, no Irish. And it was very, very difficult for them to find accommodation. There were also problems in employment, and problems in terms of social welfare. It was often impossible for people to bring their families over, so you had a lot of young men who found themselves alone. And this image from the book The Lonely Londoners by Sam Selvon is kind of evocative of that loneliness. And in the book he talks about the experience of these young black workers, if you like, living in London, often, you know, several to a room, often some people sleeping in the day and working in the night and then swapping over, and what that meant for their existence, being far away from home, but nonetheless staying here and becoming part of the society. Okay, so let's turn to the beginnings of legislation on immigration. Britain is the first country in Europe to bring in immigration legislation in 1905. The 1905 Aliens Act was actually brought in to try to curb the arrival of Jews from Eastern Europe, many of whom were fleeing persecution and pogroms at this time. We were in an era at that stage before the invention of the passport, before the invention of border restrictions. It was quite common for people to move freely across borders on the European continent. That was the experience of everybody, that if need be, they could move, and people often did. So it wasn't until very, very late, the beginning of the 20th century, as you can see here, that people actually thought, the governments actually thought it would be necessary to start to restrict immigration. And a lot of the concerns that people had, or at least the government tried to mobilize at this time, were the same types of concerns that they have today. The idea that Jews were taking people's jobs, that too many Jews within the society would dilute the national character. So you can see that kind of overrunning theme that is still very common today when we read the tabloid press and the type of discourse that is common in relation to immigration. Okay, so jumping forward to there, in 1962 is the first Immigration Act. The 1962 Commonwealth Immigration Act was a reaction to the Notting Hill riots. We'll be looking at the effect of uprisings or riots on British race relations in week 7 when we look at race, crime and civil unrest. But it's interesting to note that the 1958 Notting Hill riots, which were not actually the traditional kind of quote-unquote race riots of, if you like, disgruntled ethnic minorities in the way that we come to think about it today, they were actually riots by local white population against black people living in Notting Hill who were quite surprised to be met with, you know, violence by their neighbours. Nonetheless, this first kind of unease, if you like, in the kind of race relations between different populations living in close quarters brought the government to think that really it had to start thinking about curbing immigration. But this was quite difficult because, of course, as you can see in the name of the Act, it was the Commonwealth Immigration Act. And these are, it's a misnomer, if you like, because on the one hand you have the Commonwealth, which is supposed to be inclusive of everybody who's a subject of, you know, the Britain and its former colonies, now renamed the Commonwealth, and this idea of immigration, which of course is about inclusion and exclusion. So you're having these people who were subjects, if you like, of the British Commonwealth, now in this new move, starting to be excluded from the idea of Britishness. Although this was painted as being quite a new move, according to Arun Kudnani in his 2007 book, I'll be talking a little bit about later, the government actually was always uncomfortable with black and Asian immigration, and there were always elements within it who were opposed to a kind of a multiracial conception of Britishness. So what was happening was that once the need for cheap labour had come to a close, so once, I mean, we're talking about now 1962, almost 20 years since the end of the Second World War, and that the rebuilding of Britain had really been achieved, you no longer had this desperate need for labour to come in from the outside, it was possible to start restricting the entry of those who had previously seen as legitimate citizens, as members of the Commonwealth. What happened with the 1962 Act is actually there was a start of a racial conception of nationality and a divide between what was thought of as the old Commonwealth and the new Commonwealth. Interestingly enough, the old Commonwealth was actually were countries whose citizens were mainly white, countries like Australia and Canada, whereas the new Commonwealth were countries where citizens were mainly black or brown, so India, Pakistan, and the Caribbean. And what this was essentially was a divide between, based on colour, on the colour line. So this conceptualization of old and new Commonwealth was an all too obvious dividing line between who could be considered an insider and who could be considered an outsider, and that was always mediated by skin colour. Okay, at the same time as you had the beginnings of thinking about restricting immigration, where basically under the 1962 Act, it was no longer possible for any new immigrants to come in. The only people who were able to come in were families who were joining migrants who already lived in the country. Wives and sons and daughters, perhaps mothers and fathers could join. But after that, there was a complete end to what was known as primary immigration. At the same time, there was a necessity to start thinking about something called race relations. There were a few race relations acts that were brought in the 1960s, 1965, elaborated upon in 1968, and later in 1976. And this agenda of race relations led to the Commission for Racial Equality and other governmental bodies who were established to kind of keep the peace, if you like, or at least try to analyse the roots of racist discrimination and try to bring in policy that could curb that. Roy Jenkins, who was Home Secretary at the time, defined race relations as equal opportunity accompanied by cultural diversity in an atmosphere of mutual tolerance. And this idea, which you could think about as being as a kind of a cultural laissez-faire attitude, really defined Britain's attitude to race relations until quite recently. It was this idea, basically, that as long as everybody could get along, the government was not going to intervene strongly in people's cultural affairs that were seen as private. Of course, there was a strict divide between the cultural sphere and the political sphere, and certainly the legislative sphere, or the areas of crime and so on. There, the government did intervene quite directly, and we see that with the uprisings through the 70s and then 80s, when there was a kind of a very sharp policing of so-called immigrant communities or black and ethnic minority communities. But nonetheless, this idea of kind of letting people get on with whatever they wanted to do in their own private sphere was very much kind of at the heart of at least the official ideas about what race relations were all about. At the same time, you had the establishment of the Institute of Race Relations, where the idea was that in order to understand on a global sphere the anti-colonial movement, you had to also understand these relationships between what were still conceived of as being different racial groups in the British situation. Okay, the Institute of Race Relations that later goes to break off and become an independent anti-racist group, but interestingly has this history within the Foreign Office. Okay, so at this time, you of course have the beginnings of racist reactions amongst the population. And when I asked at the beginning of the lecture whether or not we can think about these as being real sort of bottom-up reactions, or whether in a sense there was a kind of a mobilization from the top down, I was referring in great part to Enoch Powell, who's pictured here. Enoch Powell was a Tory politician who was quite influential. The Tories were in opposition at this time, but he was nonetheless a front bencher. He was very influential, especially on the right wing of the Tory party. And he's been seen, if you like, as a spokesperson for everything that's wrong with Britain in terms of immigration, and still lauded despite the fact that he's no longer alive. Suffices to go on the internet and see the amount of sites that are devoted to his brilliance in terms of, you know, analysing the situation, the threat of immigration, as the right wing sees it. I just have a short film here from...
We must be mad. Literally mad as a nation to be permitting the annual inflow of some 50,000 dependents who are for the most part the material of the future growth of the immigrant descended population. It is like watching a nation busily engaged in heaping up its own funeral pile.
Okay, so this isn't a quote from an excerpt from Enoch Powell's Rivers of Blood speech, but that speech was perhaps the most important speech that Enoch Powell has been identified with. It's called the Rivers of Blood speech because he refers to the rivers of England flowing with blood once basically the country descends into complete anarchy because immigrants have taken over to such a large extent. And this was very evocative for many, many members of the population. In the speech, Powell quotes one of his constituents. His speech is done in this very kind of colloquial sense. He's trying to say, I'm like the common man, I've understood what the common man wants. And he talks about a meeting, apparently, with one of the members of his constituency, who says the following. He says, I have three children. All of them have been through grammar school, and two of them married now with family. I shan't be satisfied until I have seen them settled overseas. In this country, in 15 or 20 years' time, the black man will have the whip hand over the white man. Powell goes on to say in the speech, you know, you must be thinking, how can I use this terrible language, but it's up to me to speak with honesty, using again this language of, you know, speaking up for the common man. And he goes on to say, talking about his constituent, here is a decent, ordinary fellow Englishman who in broad daylight in my own town says to me, his Member of Parliament, that this country will not be worth living in for his children. I simply do not have the right to shrug my shoulders and think about something else. So Powell sets himself up as a kind of, you know, the fighter for the common person who is scared that, as his constituent said, the black man will have the whip hand over the white man in the future. Of course, you know, with about, what is this now, 40 years of hindsight, the Rivers of Blood speech was 1968, we know that this isn't the case, but we can see nonetheless how in the same way when we read in the tabloid press or when the BNP kind of makes these evocative speeches, how this somehow rings true with people, especially in an atmosphere of fear and anxiety about work, about social welfare, and about getting on in life. which I think is common to all people. And this kind of, when we spoke last week about the way race works in terms of stereotyping and scapegoating people, we understand how this type of evocative language is very powerful in this kind of idea that we must protect our own and not allow the outsider to get, to use that quote again, the whip hand over us. Interestingly, Powell was actually reacting to the race relations legislation I talked about in the last slide. What he was fearful of was that what he saw as absolutely abnormal was that the British government would actually be bringing in legislation that would protect outsiders against discrimination. No, he said, it should be the white man, the white Englishman, who should be protected against discrimination from the outsiders who are coming in and stealing his jobs and stealing his houses. So 1968 is obviously in direct relation to the Race Relations Act of the same year. Powell didn't do very well on the back of the speech. He was actually demoted from the front bench of the opposition and went on. He actually moved to Ulster, and his political career did a little bit better over there. And he never, you know, retained his status as a kind of a powermonger within the Tory party. But as I said before, he's been highly influential in terms of thinking on immigration, and is still cited to this day by many, you know, anti-immigrationists on the far right. At this time, you also see the rise of the National Front, and I've put up there the picture from This Is England. I don't know if anybody has seen the film. It's definitely a good film worth seeing, which I think kind of talks about the subtleties of this, of the problem. It's important to realise, we might see this as slightly funny today, looking back in this kind of multicultural atmosphere that we apparently all live in, but in the 1970s, in a kind of an atmosphere of economic recession, where there were huge strikes, where the Labour government was not seen as doing very well, where ordinary people were seen as suffering, the National Front actually took off, and there were huge marches by the National Front on a regular basis. For example, the Battle of Lewisham. Has anybody heard of that? Battle of Lewisham, 1977, was a kind of a battle between so-called fascists and anti-fascists who were really fighting for sort of ownership or territorial kind of ownership of Lewisham. Was it going to be fascist or was it going to be anti-fascist? And when we talk about anti-racism in week 8, we'll be looking into that a little bit more. But it's important to realise that there was a kind of a real sort of popular, visceral, if you like, reaction to this idea that there were these outsiders who were taking over the country, that was mobilised by politicians like Powell, and to a certain extent was justified by the types of immigration acts that were constantly being passed, making primary immigration, as I said before, a thing of the past, making it impossible for people to come into Britain in the same way as Commonwealth subjects they were able to do in the past. Okay, in this picture we have an interesting slogan. Does anybody know what it stands for? KBW? KBW stands for Keep Britain White. And this was, you know, a graffiti that was quite commonly seen around in the 1960s and 1970s. Okay, in 1971, immigration policy becomes even stricter, and building on the 1962 Immigration Act that brings an end to primary immigration, the 1971 Act made the division between old and new Commonwealth that I spoke about before, it made it less clumsy by introducing the concept of patriality. This introduced a bloodline dimension into citizenship by claiming that only those who could trace their British ancestry back two generations were allowed to settle in the UK. So patriality basically is a concept for saying that unless you have grandparents and great-grandparents who are British and that you can prove this in some kind of way, you have no place in Britain. So at this stage, in terms of who was allowed in and who was allowed out, you could only come in if you were joining a family member who had already migrated to the country, but if you were anybody else with no links whatsoever to Britain, there was no way for you to immigrate into Britain. I think it's quite interesting, it's quite important to keep this in mind, because when we think about the history of immigration, especially in the way it's presented once again in the tabloid press and so on, there's this idea that the floodgates of Britain have always been open and people are just, you know, marching in willy-nilly, but actually you can see that it's already been, since 1962, then worked upon again in 1971, virtually impossible for anybody to come here as a so-called economic migrant. So thinking about this concept of patriality makes us think already towards what we're going to be talking about next week when we talk about citizenship and identity and what Britishness is all about. In effect, the concept of patriality introduces the idea of Britishness as whiteness. If you like, under colonialism, when Britain had this enormous empire, you know, the slogan used to say, the sun never sets on the British Empire, it's so huge, there was an idea that what Britons were proud about was the multiracial or multi-ethnic nature of the empire, that all of these people from so many backgrounds were nonetheless identifying with the king or the queen. That is over in 1971 with the concept of patriarchy. Essentially what had happened was that Britishness was entirely defined as whiteness. Remember also that this division between old and new Commonwealth meant that effectively we had also identified these other countries like Australia and Canada as being part of white Britain, whereas India, Pakistan and the Caribbean were part of this new Commonwealth that we didn't see as associated with us in any kind of way. And it's quite interesting when we think about, we'll look at it for a minute later, when we think of in terms of who are the migrants in Britain today, actually the highest proportion of people not born in Britain who live here today are people essentially white, if you like, mainly from the US. There are many Canadians and Australians, but also mainly people from other countries within the European Union, rather than people coming from Africa or Asia. The other important point, what was going on in the 1970s and late 1970, 1979, was of course that Margaret Thatcher was elected, brought about an end to the Labour era, brought about an end to this idea of race relations as Roy Jenkins defined it, and a completely kind of new agenda in terms of immigration. We'll be talking a little bit about the new racism specifically in week 5 when we talk about race and culture, but what was interesting in terms of Margaret Thatcher's victory was that she was able to integrate the anti-immigration discourse of the far right. She was able to capitalize on the success, if you like, of the National Front and draw it into the Tory party by using the same kind of evocative language against immigration as the National Front themselves were using. So Margaret Thatcher spoke about swamps, she spoke about immigration as swamping, she talks about floods of immigrants, she talks about sticking up for the ordinary British person, using the same language that Powell only some 10 years previously had been booted out of the Tory party for using, right? She manages to mobilize this large proportion of the population that would have voted for the National Front, draw them into the Conservative Party, and win the election. So really a lot of the 1979, the birth of Thatcherism, if you like, is down to her immigration policy. Okay, so let's jump on a little bit further and talk about how the view of immigration has proceeded through the 1980s and the 1990s. In the 1990s, there was a sharp rise in what are known as asylum seekers, rather than what we can distinguish as economic migrants. What was happening is that you had a rise in ethnic conflict in many regions of the world, often fueled by the West. In places like the Middle East, things like the Iran-Iraq war, the crisis of the Palestinian refugees, or situations in Latin America, such as the Chilean or the Argentinian dictatorships, people fleeing persecution, but also situations of famine and low-level, if you like, localized conflict in a lot of places across the globe, led to the situation of people needing to seek refuge in the West. Now, of course, we must remember that to this day, it's a tiny proportion of people, refugees, who actually ever leave their home country, never mind make it to Europe. The majority of people who are displaced people actually end up in refugee camps, either within their own country or in a neighboring country, okay, and never actually make it to Europe. But there is a small percentage of people who do make it to Europe, and we saw a sharp rise in this in the 1980s. So people who had never before sought to come to Britain because they had no ties to Britain, okay? Remember that the migrants who came before were Commonwealth subjects who had total entitlement to come here because, you know, they were de facto citizens, right? At this time, you had whole new populations of people, Latin Americans, various African countries who had never been colonized by Britain, coming here to seek asylum. Now, the Geneva Convention, everybody heard of the Geneva Convention? Yeah? No? No? Okay. The Geneva Convention was written, it's a treaty signed by all of the states under the United Nations, signed at the end of the Second World War in 1948, in order to basically ensure that the types of atrocities that happened in World War II would never happen again. Because after the Second World War, so many people had been displaced because they couldn't go back to their homelands, couldn't go back to their towns and villages because of persecution or because it had simply disappeared, because half of their families had been massacred and all the rest of it, these people found themselves in these displacement camps, and the Geneva Convention was written in order to protect them and allow people to go and do what we call seek asylum in a third country, which means basically going to a country that is not your own and asking them to take you in and grant you the status of refugee. The problem with the Geneva Convention is that it was conceived for a European public. Okay, it was conceived for people who basically came from basically the same type of place, okay, Europe. What happens then when it's used, when the Geneva Convention is used to protect the rights of people who come from further afield, is that there's a kind of a mismatch. So the Geneva Convention, governments start to think, is maybe perhaps not as necessary to uphold. We're not going to uphold it as stringently perhaps as we did in the past. And certainly, it wasn't really in use, if you like, from the early 1950s until the 1980s, because there wasn't this degree of people seeking asylum as there was from the 90s onwards. From the 80s onwards, sorry. So in the 90s, what you have is a backlash against this idea of bogus asylum seekers. I presume everybody has heard that phrase. Yeah? Okay. Now, what does it mean? Can anybody say what bogus asylum seekers means? Hello? Nobody? You all said you knew what it was. Yeah, go on.
Well, some people would have left the right because of conflict in their country, or that their life was in serious danger. Now there's people that claim that that's the case, but really they come from, say they even said there's fear and persecution in some of that Somalia, they may have come from some of that Eritrea, which at the moment they say they have the same conflict, which is down, but they consider they came from that in order to gain entry into war.
Right, well, that might be part of it. Basically, the idea, which comes, of course, from the tabloid press, is that there are these people who want to migrate here because Britain is what's known as a soft touch. We've heard that expression used as well in the media, no? This idea that Britain is this wonderful place where everybody gets benefits, where everybody gets welfare, where everybody gets a job, at the detriment of the local white population, okay? And that, therefore, people who have never suffered persecution, in the way that you put it, are actually posing, if you like, as so-called economic migrants who don't really have a right to seek asylum under the Geneva Convention and wanting to come in here. And there was this idea in the 1990s that was very, very strong and still is strong today, despite, you know, the fact that the law has basically clamped down completely on asylum. This idea that this was happening all over the place, that, you know, hordes and hordes of people were coming in and pretending to be asylum seekers. What this led to was a growth in popularity of another far right wing party, not the National Front, but actually what used to be a rather smaller party called the British National Party, that has now completely eclipsed the National Front, who were seen as being total extremists. British National Party in the 1990s revamped their image, totally kind of cleaned it up from any association with the nasty elements of the far right, although if you dig a little deeper, you can actually see that all of that is still there. And basically, like Powell in 1968, who of course is one of their heroes, say, we're only speaking up for the common man and saying what is right is that all of these people are coming in and taking our jobs, pretending to be asylum seekers, where actually they're not. Forgetting, of course, that a lot of the migrant labour is actually necessary to fuel the British economy, which is a point that I'm going to get onto now. The BNP started off small. It had its first councillor elected in 1994, Derek Beacon and Tara Hamlets. And actually, when Derek Beacon was elected, there was a huge furore with anti-racist movements on the march, leading to him, you know, not actually taking up his seat. But today, the BNP is rather banalised, and they have, I mean, not that they're doing great politically, but they do have 46 council seats in Britain. So going from kind of one in 1994 that never managed to stick it to 46 today, that's kind of doing quite well. And I just thought I'd play you this rather revolting song. It's revolting and amusing at the same time, but it really kind of encapsulates the British National Party's message on asylum. I won't play you the whole thing because it's about 4 minutes long, goes on and on, but about 20 seconds should suffice.
We came to England through the tunnel last night. That's right, that's right. We claim asylum, now they're treating us right. So right, so something tells me Ahmed, this is the place to be. Cassie, we're getting everything, and we're getting it for free. Oh, and a brand new leather jacket, a brand new mobile phone. A Brits-day living cardboard boxes while we get furnished homes. Legal and driving lessons, central heating and free bills. Oh, we get all the benefits and you get all the bills.
Right, so that's a little ditty from the British National Party, readily available from YouTube, in case anybody really wants to listen to the rest of it. But you can see in the images that they flash up there, a lot of those kinds of things that evoke for people everything that's apparently wrong with Britain. These ideas, you know, the British are living in cardboard boxes and paying the bills of the asylum seekers who are living in beautiful homes. Messages there about, you know, what it is to be British, so when you see the women in burqa, we'll be getting onto that when we speak about race and gender, when we speak about racism in the context of the war on terror. All of these symbols that are kind of easily mobilized in this overarching idea that immigration is, of course, bad for Britain. Okay, so what's happening a little bit more recently, knocking it up to the 2000s, immigration and New Labour. There's really a kind of a three-sided strategy going on under New Labour. The first thing is that there's basically been an end to the right to seek asylum, and which completely contravenes, if you look at the facts completely contravene what the BNP and the tabloid press is saying. This assumption that there are thousands and thousands of asylum seekers or bogus asylum seekers coming in is actually simply untrue. It's almost impossible to seek asylum in Britain today, and has been since 1999. With the passing of the Immigration and Asylum Act in that year. If you look at the statistics, I think it's about 98% of people who try to seek asylum are refused on the first go, and then it's about something in the mid-70s, I can look up the precise statistics, who then get through on appeal. So 75% of people, more or less, are rejected. The claims to asylum are rejected. And also there are lists of countries that are considered safe countries. Iraq is on that list, for example, as is Afghanistan, which means that the British government doesn't deem it necessary for somebody from that country to actually have the right to seek asylum here, because they could easily stay at home because it's deemed a safe country. So this is the type of policies around asylum that are prevalent today. What happens with that 1999 Immigration and Asylum Act is that there's a complete end, if you like, any dregs that had still been there of the Roy Jenkins attitude, no? His 1968 claim that race relations was about equal opportunity accompanied by cultural diversity in an atmosphere of mutual tolerance, all of that kind of comes to an end with this idea that we put an end to asylum. We also at the same time put an end to the idea of multiculturalism, and that's something we'll be talking about in week 5. The second side, if you like, of New Labour's policy is one of managed migration. We'll be speaking about that briefly in a minute. And thirdly, it's integration and social cohesion, which is what we're going to be speaking about next week and the week after. Okay, so let's look first at Labour's policies on asylum. They can be summed up with three words: detention, destitution, and deportation. Okay, we spoke about the Geneva Convention before. The Geneva Convention is being almost completely rolled back. Although it still exists and all of the states have signed up to it, there are basically none of the states in Europe fully respect the Geneva Convention, which basically means that you don't have the right to send somebody seeking asylum in your country back. Okay, that it's called the law of non-refoulement. Okay, that is gone. That principle is basically being contravened by all of the European states. Under a kind of a consolidated European Union-wide approach, under the area of what's called justice, freedom and security, which is the agenda of the European Union, which takes care of border policy, asylum and migration policy. So in contrast to the idea of Britain as a soft touch, since 1999, each successive Immigration Act, which is now called, it's been renamed since 2002, they now call it the Nationality, Immigration and Asylum Act, each one has made it actually more impossible for people to seek asylum. I spoke about the kinds of numbers that I refused before. The second thing that's going on is that there's been a huge growth in detention centres. There are detention centres for asylum seekers and so-called failed asylum seekers up and down the country. Failed asylum seekers are people, of course, whose asylum claim hasn't gone through. And if caught, because of course some people do try to abscond and, you know, disappear into the black economy, which is huge in this country, if caught, they're generally detained in detention centres awaiting deportation. And often people are housed in detention centres awaiting their claim to be assessed. And this can go on for months and even years. There are people who've been in asylum detention for up to 2, 3, 4 years. Okay? These detention centres are usually run by private security firms like G4, so they kind of exist in this quite shady realm that isn't, it is obviously under government control, but there's been quite a lot of cases of abuse and violence against detainees within detention centres, and many cases of detainees driven to suicide because of the sheer desperation of their situation. Third point is that asylum seekers have been basically left destitute. Under the 2002 Nationality, Immigration and Asylum Act, Section 55 of that Act has made it incumbent upon asylum seekers to make their claims, so that is actually put in their application for asylum, and I'm quoting here from Section 55, as soon as is reasonably practicable. And nobody knows what this quite means, but usually it means within 2 weeks of arriving in British territory, you have to make your asylum claim. Now, what's happening is that people are coming over generally, from conflict situations, from incredibly difficult situations, many times not speaking the language, certainly not having any access to legal aid unless they come across an organization that can help them, or perhaps a network of friends or family who could help them already in the country, but very often not having those types of networks, and having to know that within this certain time period they have to make their claim for asylum, otherwise risk being destitute. Because normally speaking, you're looked after by the government to the extent that you get a small grant every week. It's really, pennies almost. But it, can keep people in basic food needs and all the rest of it, basic clothing needs, while their asylum claim is going through. Otherwise, you're completely destitute. And this has led to huge numbers of homelessness amongst asylum seekers who obviously didn't get their claim in time. There's also cases that have been highlighted recently of asylum seekers with small children who are also in this situation. So it's been perhaps definitive, if you like, if we can think of the main thing that's definitive of the government's policy on asylum since the 2000s, so 2002 and the passing of this Act, is this case of all of these asylum seekers left destitute on the streets. And often organisations who work with asylum seekers talk about their offices kind of doubling as makeshift camping sites for people who just can't cope on the streets anymore, especially in the dead of winter and all the rest of it. The last point that I mentioned briefly before is that there is currently deportation going on even to countries that we know are practicing human rights abuses. So countries where people say, if I'll be deported there, I will suffer torture, I will be imprisoned, for whatever reason. Perhaps you've been in political opposition, perhaps you're a gay or lesbian, for many different reasons. And nonetheless, because they're not on that list of safe countries that I spoke about before, you will be deported there. And one of the interesting cases is Iraq. I don't really have time to show the film, which is here, but there is a film which I can put later on the internet, which actually talks about the experiences of this one man who is an Iraqi Kurd who fears for his life if he'll be deported back to Iraq, and who nonetheless is on the government's list waiting deportation despite the fact that he has a British partner and all the rest of it. Unfortunately, don't have time to look at that now.
This is my right!
Sorry. Okay, so managed migration is the last thing I want to talk about today, and I'll be going into it in much greater detail over the next couple of weeks because it's quite a complex topic. But it's the phrase that's being used by New Labour since it's the publication of a white paper called Safe Haven, Secure Borders in 2005, I think it is, which basically defines the British government's attitude to migration. The story is that Britain, of course, has an ageing population. It also has a completely transformed labour market, transformed by the knowledge economy, and that leaves a gap in labour provision. You have the situation where there are demands for workers in all kinds of spheres that have basically been completely abandoned by the traditional working class, if you like, for good reasons of social progress. So there's a demand for low-skilled workers, especially in the service industry, people working as carers, as cleaners, as agricultural workers, and in manufacturing. There's also a realization that was noted in the white paper that labor migration is increasingly haphazard and impractical. What that means is that there's a lot of people coming into the country, migrating for a variety of reasons, who want to work, and that they are necessary actually for fueling the economy, but that the government doesn't have any kind of handle anymore on who they are. So it's not about saying we don't want these people here, it's really about saying we do, but how can we make that work to our effect? How can we make this work for us instead of against us? It's important to realize that this type of labor migration coming in, people tend to make this sharp distinction between forced migration, so asylum seekers and refugees, and economic migrants on the other hand. But that distinction, according to the migration theorist Stephen Castles, should be a little bit more blurred, because the reason between migrating because you have been the victim of political persecution, or perhaps for seeking a better life, you know, the distance between those two things is quite small, because whether you're fleeing persecution on political grounds or whether you're fleeing starvation, for example, because you can't feed your children, right, that difference is quite small. So it's important, he says, to actually, you know, blur that division between forced and voluntary migration. It's also true, however, that under the context of globalization, migration is growing. The part of what globalization is about is that possibility, or that desire, if you like, to move across borders. Okay, so rather than seeing migrants constantly as sort of victims of a bigger picture, there also is a certain degree of choice there. So there's these two things kind of going on. And, you know, many theorists of globalization have pointed out that while you have this possibility for goods and services to move freely across borders within the context of globalization, you have these restrictions on people moving across borders, and that the two don't really seem to go together. Okay, so managed migration is really about maximizing economic gains while limiting social and political rights. And as I say, I'll be speaking about this to a greater extent next week. But managed migration in terms of a policy is really based on the realization of the importance of the existence of these workers, people who want to work within the economy, coming from a wide variety of countries, for driving the British economy. There's a realization that because of the changing demographics, because, you know, the population is getting older, because of the knowledge economy, that this gap means that we simply need people to work, not only as unskilled workers, but also on the other side, as skilled workers. When we talk about IT workers from India, doctors, nurses, all of these economies where people, there's simply a lack of local people to work in there, there's a need for labour to be brought from the outside. So what managed migration does is basically create this kind of system, this tiered system with high-skilled workers at the top and low-skilled workers at the bottom, and different types of social rights and entitlements that go with that. So the lower skilled you are, if you like, the less social and political rights you have. So it's a situation of kind of, you know, creating a sharp divide between labour on the one side and political participation and integration on the other. So if you like, drawing this complete link, closing the circle between Britishness and immigration. So really defining Britishness as this kind of the inner circle, if you like, with all of these kind of peripheral people who we let in to work under this tightly controlled system of managed migration, but whom we never allow into the body politic, if you like, who we never allow into, who we never allow to participate fully in the politics, social life, economy, and cultural life of the society. So, if you like, it's really creating these kind of parallel societies, not just one, because of course we have these different tiers of labourers who are, you know, accounted for under the managed migration system, but several kind of tiers, parallel universes, parallel societies, all existing at the same time. Okay, so as I said, I'm going to be going into that in greater detail in the next couple of weeks. For the moment, it's important to recognise that in terms of the crisis of immigration, if you like, that I began by speaking about, the managed migration system is creating an underclass of migrant workers, either those at the low-skilled end of the managed migration system itself, who are legal, if you like, but also a complete kind of invisible black economy of people who come here and who disappear into that gaping hole, if you like. There is work for them. There's work for them in a whole range of sectors where people are quite happy not to pay the minimum wage, not to pay social security, and not to look after the workers. It's a type of indentured labour, if you like, because people often have to come here, give their passport over to their employer, which means that they can't go anywhere, and live often in fear of being caught, detained, and deported, while servicing a lot of our industries. And, you know, the campaign of Justice for Janitors recently highlighted that, the situation of people who clean offices and all kinds of places in the middle of the night, who are basically paid like half the minimum wage and have no rights to, you know, to the NHS or any of the kind of basic rights that other workers have. These people who are invisible often fuel the sex industry, they fuel the hotel and the service industry, they are our carers and nurses, and they do dangerous and risky work that the majority of British people quite rightly refuse to do. We'll see these themes coming back again in week six when we talk about race and gender, because especially when we talk about sex workers and migrant women often coming on their own and leaving their families behind because it's easier for them to get work perhaps alone than it is if they come with their families. And also in week eight on anti-racism, when we talk about the roles of campaigns like by trade unions but also by Justice for Janitors and other types of migrant-led campaigns against this kind of system of parallel universes. Finally, I just wanted to make you aware of a talk that's going to be happening on October the 31st that I'll be chairing. Arun Kudnani, who's the author of The End of Tolerance, and you'll be reading, you read something, I think, from his book for this week, and you'll be reading something else, another article that he wrote next week or the week after. And he's really one of the premier thinkers on race and racism and immigration and all those issues today, working today in Britain. And he's very accessible. He's, you know, a great person to talk to. And if you do one extra thing beyond this course this year, please come in a couple of Wednesdays' time and listen to him then. Okay? Thank you very much.